Hello, and welcome to episode 11 of Positive Thinking and the Meaning of Life. My name is supercalifragilistically Marcus Freestone. And this episode is Social Interaction Part 2. When I was in junior school, we had a conversation where we concluded that the point of nursery school was to acclimatise us to being among other people before we went to proper school. If that indeed were its purpose, then in my case it failed spectacularly. Coming from a home with no siblings, no father, and no car, so we hardly ever went anywhere, suddenly being in a room with 40 other children was a massive shock. And this pattern has remained with me, really, to this day, so that I still find large social encounters overwhelming. I should introduce a rather large caveat here, which I often do at the beginning of these things. There is a difference between having psychological problems and having a medical condition. Now, I'm the last person to say that people who have social anxiety are making it up or it's not a real problem. I know it's a real problem because I've had them myself. However, I have come to the conclusion after all the research and reading and self-reflection that has led me to write the book and do these podcasts, I've come to the conclusion that the majority of my depression and anxiety throughout my life have been psychological rather than medical in nature. And if they're psychological, then medical treatments are probably not going to work. And also, if they're psychological rather than medical, then you're far more capable of dealing with them yourself, as I've done. So I guess my point in raising that is that just because you have some form of social anxiety, it doesn't mean you have a mental illness or that you need to go to a doctor. Most people have some kind of social situation that they're uncomfortable about. I would say it only becomes a medical condition when it is severely affecting your life and it's preventing you from doing things. If you will do anything to avoid leaving home, if the prospect of merely opening your front door fills you with dread and fills you with a panic that makes you feel that you're going to die, then clearly that's a problem with some kind of biological origin and you need to do something about it. But just being shy or awkward around people is not a medical condition. While nobody is ever born with a psychological or mental health condition, it is apparently possible for animals, including humans, to inherit a fear of newness or change. This rings a huge bell with me because much of my anxiety throughout my life has come from a fear of not being able to cope with a new situation or a change in my circumstances. And much of my depression has come from a dissatisfaction with my current circumstances, and therefore I've spent much of my life trapped in a vicious circle until very recently. I was often desperate to change my life, but terrified of having to deal with anything new. Therefore, I often remained stuck and assiduously avoided all opportunities to move on with my life, preferring the negative comfort of remaining a prisoner in my unsatisfactory circumstances. An example of that would be people staying in a dysfunctional or an abusive relationship. You know, better the devil you know, better to be with someone you don't get on with than to be alone, you know. By the way, it isn't. If we're in a bad relationship, get out. Sorry, that sounded a bit creepy then, doesn't it? apologise if you, you know, you might have been skipping through this on headphones late at night and then just heard me going, get out. That was worse. Anyway, so most of the changes in my life in the past have been foisted on me by external circumstances, and I've gone along with them because it's been too scary to stand up and say no. I followed the path of least resistance, and it led me to a series of dead ends. It's only been fairly recently that I've begun making proactive decisions and forcing myself to embrace new possibilities. Consequently, for the first time ever, my life is now moving in a forward, upward, and positive direction. It's quite complicated how I've come to this new positive karma functional attitude, and I'm going to try and I'm going to have a think, and I'm going to deal with that in the next episode, which will be, I guess, about, I don't know what it'll be about. I don't really know what to call how my outlook on life has changed in the last few months. I just know that all the dread and anxiety and fear that I used to have, it's just gone. It's just not there anymore. I can't access what it feels like to feel like I used to for most of my life. And I've not taken any medication, I've not had any therapy or counselling or anything. It's just, I've realised a few things about myself. And in the next episode, I'm going to try and communicate that in a way that will transcend, I think, the very specific biographical things about myself that I've worked on. Hopefully I can express it in a way that it'll mean something to everyone else listening. So look out for that next time. Where were we? Or where was I? Oh, yes. A study on the amygdala, the part of our brain that deals with our fear responses, shows that some infants have inherited an overexcitable amygdala. This means they will have a lifelong predisposition to become anxious and afraid when confronted with new stimuli. I've long realised that I was born anxious, bearing in mind the caveat I introduced at the beginning. I would bet everything I have that my amygdala would show this exact behaviour. I'm even thinking now that my depression actually arose from my underlying anxiety rather than the other way round. Because in recent months, I've dealt with the anxiety and the depression's vanished. Anxiety is fear, mostly about something that is not currently happening and will never happen. I'll say that again because it is at the crux of this. Anxiety is fear, mostly about something that is not currently happening and will never happen. If there is a tangible empirical problem in your life, then you have concrete options to deal with it. If you are afraid of something that doesn't exist, how are you supposed to deal with it? The answer is simple. Acknowledge that it doesn't exist. The potential future and the dead past cannot hurt you unless you allow them to by your modes of thinking. So, what is fear? In the vast majority of cases, it's an entirely invented state. I've spent most of my life in a state of extreme anxiety about fictional future possibilities that have almost no chance of coming to pass. Past events that no longer have any material influence on my life, or genuine present problems that are so trivial they are nothing any sensible person would waste an ounce of energy being anxious about. For most of us, most of the time, fear and anxiety is an invented fiction to which we are choosing to subject ourselves. Therefore, if you're one of those people who were born anxious, you need to recognise and acknowledge this fact and train yourself to see your state of anxiety and fear as a fictional construct of your own devising. Think back 5 or 10 years and write a list of everything you were afraid of at the time. I've just done this quickly in my head and, surprise, surprise, none of it ever happened. So many things a few years ago I thought were going to ruin my life to such an extent, I was so afraid of them, I thought I'd be better off killing myself. And none of the things I worried about ever happened. And any genuine problems that I thought were insurmountable were so trivial, I just swatted them aside. I've come to realise that what has ruined large chunks of my life has been not the physical, material or social circumstances of my life, but the constant buzzing of invented fear in my head that obliterated all the positive things that were in my life. If you're listening to this podcast, then you have internet access and a device on which to play the audio file. Even this simple fact, which I'm sure, as I do, you take entirely for granted, means that you're vastly better off than 80% of the world. You almost certainly have adequate food and shelter and don't live in a war zone or under a repressive government. So what do you really have to be afraid of? Although I've often been poor by Western standards, gone without heating and food for short periods, it was never going to kill me. Everything I've ever been anxious or depressed about has been very much the ubiquitous phenomena known as Western problems. I've never had to worry about starving to death, being imprisoned by secret police, my country being bombed or invaded, the economy collapsing to the point where life becomes untenable. All my worries have been trivial social and existential concerns that my faulty brain has distorted and amplified into a totally indulgent and self-important sense of anxiety. I say self-important deliberately because I think this is a key point we need to emphasise. Who says that we are so important that our feeling socially awkward or physically inadequate is such a tragedy that we need to call it a clinical illness? Where is the rule that says we're entitled to a life of constant, unbridled joy and success? Getting back to social interaction, there's a natural tendency to compare ourselves to others, often unfavourably, and I have a recent example from my own life that perfectly illustrates this. And I think this was about 3 months ago, and this is the beginning of me waking up and shedding my redundant anxiety. About 3 months ago, I started a training course, and the first week I turned up and immediately felt, despite my having giving myself a good talking to before I got there and saying, okay, don't let this happen again, it always happens, be positive, but it still happened. Soon as I got there, I thought, oh, everybody's got a really good job, everybody's got a car, I've never owned a car, everybody's clearly much more successful than me, most of them are younger than me, they've done far better with their lives than I have, everyone thinks I'm the failure in the room, and I kind of went to pieces. And the few days after the course, I was very depressed and almost gave up on the course, even though it's something I really wanted to do. And those few days turned out to be crucial. And where during that week, I, in ways that I'll get around to in the next podcast, when I sort of sorted my head out and I went back the second week with a non-distorted view of myself and the world, I found that, of course, nobody was looking down on me. Everybody was being really nice. And I've just finished the course a couple of days ago, and it turned out to be a really fun experience. And someone passed around a sheet of paper at the end, and everyone put their email address on, and we're all going to keep in touch. And I had nothing, you know, there was no basis in my feelings of inadequacy for that first week. And as I'd done many, many times in my life, but I'm determined not to do anymore, the other people weren't alienating me. I was alienating myself from them with my negative attitude. My negative attitude about myself. So I'll talk about that more next time. Okay. As well as the amygdala predisposing you towards anxiety, there's also the eternal problem, which I talk about in the book, of precedent, repeating and reinforcing patterns of behaviour and early childhood experiences. Many studies have been done on infant-mother separation, and they clearly show that some babies remain relaxed if briefly parted from their mother, providing they have some other human company and some kind of engaging stimuli, such as toys to play with. Other babies will cry and scream within seconds of their mother leaving the room, and nothing will mollify them except her immediate return. From what I can remember of my early life, I definitely fall into the latter category, and it's no surprise to discover that these anxious infants, when studied 10, 20 years later, grow into anxious adults. There is, of course, no template or method for bringing up the perfectly well-adjusted child. Too much attention and affection will leave you unprepared for the vicissitudes of the adult world. Too little will leave you anxious and lacking in social confidence and self-esteem. I can't imagine how hard it is to be a teenager now. I don't know any teenagers at the moment, as it happens. My friends' kids are all much younger. I would never have coped with being in school in the digital environment of today. I was 16 in 1988. Nobody but a few executives had mobile phones, there was no internet, and cameras were large, expensive items you carried around in a special bag. There was certainly no surreptitious taking a photo of you. If someone took a photo of you, you basically had to stand still while they got the equipment ready to do it. I was bullied and ostracized in school, but there was nobody I wanted to be friends with whom I wasn't. I hated most boys in my school and wanted nothing to do with them, so I was mainly friends with girls. Mostly, I was just ignored, which suited me perfectly. Now, I would, I'm 100% sure, be constantly bothered by people taking surreptitious photos of me and posting them on Facebook with insulting comments and exhortations to kill yourself, you weirdo loser. I know I would have coped very badly with this and probably hurt either myself or one of the bullies. In my teenage years, when you left school at the end of the day, that was it. There was no way for any bullies to contact me. They wouldn't even know where I lived. In those days, you only kept in contact with someone if you made a substantial effort and if it was a two-way process. You would either phone them on a landline, if they had told you their number, or call round to their home, if they told you their address. If somebody had an unusual surname, you could look them up in the phone directory, but that was the only way of finding somebody's contact details. As a teenager now, you'd have to be virtually Amish to be completely uncontactable online, and doubtless suffer the consequent ridicule. The web and digital technology gives young people huge creative and social outlets that I never had, but it also makes them targets in a way I never was. On the other hand, I think one positive thing that's happened in the 30 years since I was in school is that, and I kind of hate myself for saying this phrase, it's a kind of terrible cliche, but, and I think there are things about it I don't like, but the idea of it's cool to be a geek. Now, the word geek wasn't really around so much in the 80s. I think it was used, but not to the extent it is now. I think perhaps there's more of an acknowledgement in the mainstream of people's eccentricities. I think maybe while I'm, you know, unfortunately, we know it's the case that with Facebook and mobile phones and that kids can be more bullied, and we know there are awful cases where, you know, kids as young as junior school age are hanging themselves or whatever because they can't face the torment, and that still does happen. But I think maybe things have become slightly more positive in that there are popular geeky people being portrayed in the media, perhaps. I'm not entirely sure what I'm saying now, but I hope you kind of get the gist of it, that perhaps one of the positive things to come out of what I think is a very negative thing, which is the complete fragmentation of all aspects of society, and that, you know, there are hundreds of subgenres of music and everything seems to be compartmentalized into a smaller and smaller box. And I think a lot of these divisions are artificial and counterproductive. But maybe as a part of that, now, if I think maybe, you know, being weird or being an outsider isn't as much of a thing as it was, because 30 years ago there weren't that many categories to fit people into. Now there are so many. You know, you've got the recognition of transgender and all this sort of thing, and so many different genres of music and culture and all sorts of things. And certainly, I think we've got past the sort of situation that was around when I was a kid, which was if as a man you had long hair, you were likely to be, you know, picked on by the police just for that very fact. If you looked even slightly unconventional, people would cross the street to avoid you. Now, you see, you go in a shop or an office and there's people with all sorts of piercings and weird coloured hair and straight big hairstyles and that, and nobody seems to really bother anymore. And I think that's a very positive thing. You know, we shouldn't live in a world where, you know, teenage kids are picked on just because they dress like a goth or whatever. It's such a shallow thing to divide people up like that. It makes me really angry. But anyway, try and end on a positive note. So I think as well, so if you're a young person listening to this and you're a goth or an emo or whatever you call them these days, or you're into something that's outside the mainstream, at least you have the opportunity to interact online with other people who are into the thing that you're into. I never had that. I was kind of ostracized in school for being into heavy metal in the 80s, and there were two other kids in my whole school who were into metal. That was it. I didn't know anybody else. So I think that's maybe a positive thing, and there are, you know, there are outlets for it, I think. That doesn't make sense, so I'll have to think about that when I edit it. Okay, so we got there in the end. So that was episode 11 of the Positive Thinking and the Meaning of Life podcast, he said, redundantly saying the word podcast again. It was written and spoken and recorded and eviscerated by the carbon-based entity that is me, Marcus Freestone. And if you like the podcast, please tell everyone you know about it. Join the Google Plus page, join the Facebook page, post about it, open your bedroom window and shout to passing postman about it. Yeah, and if you feel it's really changed your life, then chuck me a couple of quid by the donate button or buy one of my books or albums or whatever. MarcusFreestone.com, there's you can get the free ebook that's now up to about 60,000 downloads. There's my other comedy podcast. There's loads of free music and some other free ebooks and some other stuff that isn't free. And there's little pictures on there that you can click and go to other bits of the interwebs. So enjoy all that, and I'll see you next time. Bye.